And welcome to episode 8 of the Instant Offense Podcast. I'm James Hollis of bballbreakdown.com. Wow. So after last episode, let's keep our fingers crossed that things go a lot smoother. I had on Zach Palmer from Orlando Magic Daily, and things, yeah, I'm not proud of that episode. I apologize to everybody out there listening. It did not go well. But today, I think I got a good luck charm. I'm joined by HawksHoop.com's Bo Cherney. Bo, you there?
I am. How's everything going?
Oh, man, it's going a lot better this time. Me and Zach, on Twitter, he's a former tank commander. We recorded. First of all, he got off work late, so we were going to record late the first day. First day, he got something happened on the highway and held him up, so we didn't record. So I stayed up to 11:30 for nothing. Next day, he came on, we recorded, and somehow Blog Talk Radio dropped the recording. So we recorded again an hour later, and then still dropped the call like twice. It was a big pain in the butt. So hopefully things go a lot better this time. What's going on with you, man? How's your summer going? How's your summer going so far?
Pretty good, pretty good. Got a started a full-time job this summer. We got out of college in May, so we got a full-time job almost out of that. Been working hard. I haven't been watching as much. Didn't get to watch as much of the finals as I wanted to, but otherwise it's all been good. Getting geared up for both college football season, which is what I'm covering now, and upcoming NBA season. So looking forward to a lot of fun. A lot of fun coming up.
Okay, where are you covering the football season for? Go ahead, plug your spot, man.
Yeah, FanBuzz.com is where I'll be covering college football this year. Doing a little bit of other stuff, but mostly college football, maybe a little NFL, but getting in that football grind and that football money, and I'll take it.
Hey, man, if somebody paid me good money to cover, I don't know, bocce ball or cover, I don't know, lawn bowling, I'd be there too. I dig it. How long? So, are you a Hawks fan? How long have you been a Hawks fan?
My whole life. I've lived in Atlanta pretty much my whole life. So, they've been the local basketball team. I got into them a little more in around 2008 when they stopped sucking. But pretty much, yeah, I'm a Hawks fan pretty much my whole life, and nice to see them doing well.
What's your earliest memory of the Hawks?
Hold on. Are we allowed to curse on here?
I'm going to say sure. Why not? Probably, yeah, I guess. I don't know.
Fucking Vince Carter. like 2002, comes into Phillips Arena. I think it might have been my first game, you know, watching at Phillips Arena, but dude dropped 43 on the Hawks. Of course, you know, the Hawks weren't really that great at that point, so of course they lost. But Vince Carter comes in nailing everything. God, I hated that dude for so long because of that. That was my first memory of the Hawks, though. The Vince Carter.
It got you.
Dropped a solid 43.
You know what's crazy? I think we're going to look back in a few years, and I think he's going to be criminally underrated. Vince Carter is going to be almost like a footnote in this period of time of basketball because of guys like Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal. I don't think a lot of people realize how genuinely awesome he was at his peak.
Not only that, he's had awkward longevity. He's still going. I mean, he wasn't that good this year, but for someone that relied so much on his athleticism younger, I don't think most people would have expected him to still be going at 38. He did have some good years in Dallas when in his late 30s, so I don't think anybody would have expected that. Last year, he's kind of,
yeah.
So
you're right.
Pretty good longevity there.
He definitely dispelled the Jess Dunker thing as he got older, and he showed off a nice 3-point stroke, and people never understood he had a really nice floor game. You know, he was a very good passer, even in his prime. You know, he scored a lot of points and had to highlight dunks, but he's still averaging probably 5 rebounds and almost 5 assists. The guy, he could really play ball. He got overshadowed by the dunk. Yeah. All right, we're not turning this to me and you can sit here and talk Vince Carter all night. Let's give the people what they want. So. I was one of the few people going into the season last year. I understood that at the end of the 2014 season, that wasn't the Hawks because Al Horford missed a lot of time that year. So even though they lost to the Pacers at the end of 2014 season, I knew what they were, I think they were capable of a lot more. Al Horford is one of my favorite players in the league right now. So I saw all the preseason prognostication last season. People had them miss the playoffs. People had them, you know, oh, they're going to be scrapping for a 7th-8 seed. They're going to be worse than the Knicks. I saw all this nonsense, and I kept saying they're going to be a top 3 seed in the East.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so talk to me about your feelings. Let's go through the season. When the season started off and you guys came out the gates kicking butt a little bit, what was that like for you?
Well, I think they actually started off the season a little bit slow, about the first 10 games, and that's when everybody started to get on a bit. It's like, oh, here it goes, you know, because I was talking high on them, too. I thought they were capable of winning 50 games before the season. That's where I thought, it's like, hey, they could legitimately be up there, be, you know, sort of one of the lower contenders, at least, maybe not the contender. But, you know, they come out and get a little slow. I think they started off like 7-6. And everybody's like, oh, here it goes, classic Atlanta. They'll be, you know, they'll win 43 games. You know, they'll be, you know, attempt to be the most mediocre team possible. And then they just started lighting it up. I think they won like 10 in a row. And then, of course, they had that, 21-game winning streak, I think is what it ended at.
Mm-hmm.
19-game winning streak later in the season. It started ripping off wins, and it was ridiculous as someone who was there at practically every home game, start to see the crowd warm up to the team. You see, like, you know, they start coming out more in the middle of the season. I remember the key turning point was December 26th against Milwaukee. It was Milwaukee. I mean,
right.
Atlanta, in their past, it's like they sell out certain games. They sell out, you know, Lakers, you know, recently Clippers, Knicks, you know, Miami, big name teams. They usually win when you see the sellouts. And it was during the holidays, but they sold out Milwaukee. You know, 19,000 there. That's not what the Hawks do. I was like looking around. It's like, holy crap, this many people here, they're here to see the Hawks. You know, they're not here to see some other team. They're there to see the Hawks. And I was like, oh, wow, this could be a special year. And I think it did actually wind up being a special year. They won 60 games. They were ridiculous in the middle of the season when they were completely healthy. It was just a really fun season to watch. And I don't think we've had that in Atlanta for a long time.
And, yeah, it was a lot of fun for me as a basketball fan in general, too, to see – they actually earned that, you know, they earned the nickname, Spurs East. And Coach Bud did an amazing job putting that talent together. And, you know, you guys didn't have one dominant star, but it was like a machine. It was amazing to watch. But like you were just saying, that December game against Milwaukee, almost in, quote-unquote, in stereotypical, negative stereotypically Hawks fashion, they lost that game by 30. You know, it didn't matter. It's a regular season game. But,
that's actually what I thought. I was like, after the game, they lost by 30. And I was like, oh, crap, there goes our chance to get the city involved. Like, they show up for one game, we get blown out by 30.
Right.
But then they kept coming out.
After that, guys, you ripped off that. I think right after that, actually, yes, not. I think right after that, you guys went to Milwaukee, you beat them, and you ran off
19 in a row.
Like, there you go. Your next loss was February 2nd. You guys were just on in fuego. But by the time the playoffs rolled around, you guys, it's a different story. Injuries, of course. I mean, and this is the thing. This is why I hate when people do this kind of thing. The people start coming out of the woodwork at the end of the season, and they started the whole nonsense of, well, see, this is the Hawks. We told you they were a mirage, but with no context. Al Horford had like a broken finger or a dislocated finger. Millsap's shoulder was wonky. You guys ended up losing Tabo to that, you know, unfortunate. We'll talk about that later on, too. You lost Tabo. Then when the time you got to LeBron, those guys, I mean, for game one, Carroll hurt his knee, so he was limited, and he's had to guard LeBron. Game two, you lost Korver, and that's a wrap. I mean, it's two different things, right? They're not mutually exclusive. Yes, you end the season kind of disappointingly, on a whimper, not a bang. But, I mean, there's a reason why. It's not just because you're the Hawks. Talk to me about how you felt the atmosphere, I guess, around the city, or at least with you and your guys. How did you guys feel at the end of the season?
I think it was a bit of a letdown. I think we'd gotten, you know, started drinking the Kool-Aid a little bit, seeing us with 60 wins up there, which was a franchise record, something no one's ever seen before. Because, like, you know, we get there, it's like, oh crap, they could do this. I mean, Golden State's a monster, but I mean, they get there, anything can happen. It's, you know, they come up, you know, they have the, you know, Tavo was already out, then Millsap messed up his shoulder, Horford dislocated his finger, and then Carroll goes down, Korver goes down. It's just like, holy crap, are you kidding me? Like, this was supposed to, you know, you sort of think, it's like, oh, this was the year. They had 60 wins. But at the same time, you know, they had 60 wins. They did make the franchise record. They got to the Eastern Conference Finals for the first time ever. I don't think a lot of people realize that when they talk about the Hawks. You know, they just think, it's like, oh, the Hawks, you know, they had Dominique at some point. They were good at some point. They don't consider the fact that they had never gotten past the second round of the playoffs. So it was, you know, it was a little disappointing, but, you know, that you see, it's like, hey, there's something here. Like, there's a future for it, I guess. You have what seems like good guys in place. So, you know, they re-signed Millsap, Horford here for at least one more year. They have guys, you know, Teague, Schroeder, Korver. They have all that. You see, of course, Coach Budenholzer and GM Wes Wilcox, but you see those guys. It's like, okay, this is a good thing to have going here.
Right.
Maybe they didn't. Maybe they came up short. Maybe they, you know, they got swept in these conference finals. It's like, you know, the pieces are there. We have a good team going forward. Whereas it felt like in the Joe Johnson years, they had the one year they won 53 games. You know, all those guys kept coming back. You know, some of those guys kept coming back. You know, Josh Smith, Al Horford.
Right.
Joe Johnson, you know, was coming back for a little bit. It was just like there, but when you saw that there, no one trusted the front office. No one trusted the owners. Of course, the owners are gone now too. It's like, then it's like, okay, what, you know, we never know what could happen. You know, Josh Smith was in trade rumors for legitimately like six seasons. So it was always like, okay, they're going to trade Josh at some point, and it's going to be all scrambled. We're not going to be able to trust anybody. We don't know who the head coach could be, because Woodson was about to be fired at that point. So it's like, to go from there, it's like a point of, we don't know what we could be. We have no idea what's going to happen almost, you know, day to day, season to season. In that case, now it's like, hey, we have something good here. We have people we can trust in the system. We know that they can potentially go out and get players if they need to. So I think, you know, despite that loss in these conference finals, I think it's like, hey, we've got something going forward. This was a step. This was a step up, whereas in a lot of seasons before, the Hawks had taken a step backwards, stood pat. So now it's like, hey, we're going forward. And I think a lot of people are excited about that. I think that also helps. I like to see what happens, you know, first couple games of the season, what kind of crowd turnout they get. I think that'll determine how much the city's changed on their perception of them. And I think it'll be positive.
Right, and it's funny because a lot of people try to point Atlanta and say, see, this is a team that didn't have to tank, they rebuilt great. But, I mean, when you look at since 2000, let me see, 2000, 28 wins, then it was 25, 33, 35, 28, 13 in 2004, 2005, 26, 30. That kind of mediocrity rolled on. You guys made the Eastern Conference semis and lost, like you said, with Joe Johnson and mm-hmm. In 08 and 09, but I mean, no one thought that team was a contender, right? And it's true. I mean, and hats off. They finally they put the roster together and they got the right coach with Coach Bud, that they didn't have to, you know, to have to tank and really trash it down to rebuild. But I mean, we're talking about 12 years of mediocrity before they finally got together. Nobody really wants that. But the point is, you're here now, and you're here mm-hmm. now, and you had a very successful last season. Let's look at some of the moves you guys made so far this offseason. I thought Carroll, and I'm pretty sure you agree, everyone's going to agree, DeMarc Carroll was huge for you guys last year. He was a surprise. He was a very pleasant surprise. He's very good. And he moved on and took a lot more money. You guys replaced him with Tim Hardaway Jr., and you could have had Kelly Oubre, which I was pulling for that option. So you also added Tiago Splitter. You got, well, Walter Tavares coming over. Any idea when Tabo's – is he – projected to be back healthy, ready for the next season?
I don't know if he's supposed to be ready for the start of the season, but I think the idea is that he will be, you know, sort of at least practicing and stuff around the start of the season. He'll be around to where he could potentially start. I think it's all still depending on how well his injuries heal between now and the start of the season.
Right.
So I think there's potential he could be there, but I think they're going to probably play it carefully.
Okay. How about Korver? I know Korver, I think he had surgery too, right? His injury. And what's the prognosis on him?
I think the prognosis on him is that he is supposed to be ready by the start of the season. His injury wound up being less severe than they originally thought it was.
That's good.
So
that's
he
good.
Should, he should be ready by the start of the season.
That's huge for you guys. You guys retain the services of Paul Millsap. He's making big money, but I think he's worth every cent. So give me go ahead. I want to let you take it. Talk to me about the offseason a little bit. Thumbs up, thumbs down, and give me some reasons why.
Thumbs in the middle, they had the draft day trade where they traded essentially out of the first round for Tim Hardaway Jr., and I was not a fan of that move at the time. I've warmed up to it a little bit. Like, I've gotten the idea of why they got him. They believe, you know, in New York, he wasn't in the right situation. They weren't, you know, putting him in situations to succeed on both offense and defense. And they think, you know, coming into a team with a system, you know, he's a decent shooter. He can go ISO a little bit if you need him to. I think that, you know, they were like, okay, if we give him a system and things where we're going to put him in situations to succeed, and he will, I get that. And so I've warmed up on a little bit on that move because of that. But I'm still skeptical because he hasn't really proven a lot. He's not a good defender, or at least he wasn't in New York. So he's going to have a lot to prove with me until I you know, say it's like, okay, that was a success because they got him. He'll have to really prove that to me.
So let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question. I don't. I'm asking. I sure you don't know. Did they make that move because they liked Tim Hardaway Jr. that much, or did they make that move because they weren't fond of Kelly Oubre or whoever they would have been picking then, and they didn't want to deal with a rookie? What was the thinking? Do you have any idea?
They made that move because they value proven talent over unknown talents in the draft.
Okay.
So, you know, draft is complete question marks. It's like they know what Tim Hardaway Jr. has to offer to an NBA team. He's still young, too. He's 23, I think. 22, 23. So I think it's like, okay, this guy, we know he can contribute a little bit. Whereas, you know, drafting late first round, sort of, you know, past 15, past a lottery, you're looking at, okay, this guy could be a contributor in a few years, probably.
Got it.
But you're,
they
wanted,
you know,
a lot of, yeah, they wanted a guy that, like, okay, we know what this guy can come in and do immediately, as far as, you know, a draft pick could be, you know, he could maybe be good to go immediately. But at that rate, he's probably going to be, you know, at least a year or two behind the curve before he's actually a contributor.
Okay.
So that's why they made that move.
Hey, I'm with you. I'm still – I talked myself into it as far as, all right, well, the Knicks were a mess. We saw what JR did when he got into some structure in Cleveland versus what he was doing in New York. So they were a mess, and he's a young talent. I remember how high everybody was on Tim Hardaway Jr. at the end of the 14 season. So that – there's a possibility. So I'm sorry, I cut you off. So, all right, so Tim Hardaway Jr., they made the move. You're our the now.
So after that, I think I think that was the skeptical move I thought they made.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, going back to, you know, something positive, retaining Millsap was absolutely necessary. I'm glad they did that. They got him for a relatively good price. He'll be making about $19 million a year over the next 3 years. I was concerned they were going to offer him the max, but which would have been, I think, for him, because the way the early birds rights were, like, weird working with him. It was like 4 for 80, 4 for 85, something really high. And I was like, I don't know if I'd want to offer that to, you know.
Wow.
No, that's good. He'll age well for his game. You know, he's able to play a little bit of the post, but he's able, you know, getting a shooting stroke, so he'll age well. But it's like, I don't want to pay Millsap, you know, that much money over the next, but that amount of years. So now I think it's $358, and I think there's an opt out in there somewhere. So I think that's a lot better, and I think that was a really good move that they made. He does everything. That's the best way to sum up Paul Millsap. He does a little bit of everything. Can post up, can shoot, mid range, 3-pointer. Plays defense really well. Really underrated defender. He's everywhere on defense.
Yeah,
he's real strong. I don't think a lot of
quick hands. Real strong, quick hands,
yeah. Yeah, extremely quick hands. Great knowledge of where to be. But, you know, that's not really something you can quantify a lot, but you just see it's like, you know, whenever there's, you know, defensive situations, he's just there. Him and Horford are both the guys that know where to be on the floor on defense, and that's why the Hawks were sixth in defensive rating last year, despite, you know, they don't have a rim protector. Well, they have a bunch of guys that know where to be on defense, and that can work too.
Yep.
Other moves that they made, of course, Damari walking, that was the right move. You couldn't have given Damari that much.
What was Damari worth to you, if you think? You're the GM and you're not being against anyone else. What is he worth to you? How much would you have paid him with the new cap and everything going up?
The big problem was you couldn't have retained him and Millsap.
So if I
didn't have that issue, I don't know if I could still buy myself into 4 for $60, but I could definitely buy myself into like a, you know, 4 for $50 or 4 for $48, a little close to it. But since, you know, they were betting against themselves essentially, because it's like, okay, we could retain this guy, but if we, you know, if we put all our money into Mari, we can't get Millsap.
Right.
And
so it's definitely not worth it then.
Definitely no offense to Mari. I love him. He's a great player. But Damari's skills are a little more replaceable than Millsap's skills.
Agree. 300%.
I think, we'll find that out in Toronto. He'll have some adjusting to do. I think he's capable of adjusting a little bit and will be fine after a couple months or so. But I think he'll have a slow start to the season because he won't have the same system. I don't think it will be as successful overall that he was in Atlanta either, because there is no system really in Toronto on offense. It's kind of all over the place. But
I agree 100%. I worry that too much is going to be expected of him in that kind of like that ISO perimeter heavy offense in Toronto. And I hope people don't think he's a bust, because he's going to do what he does. He hustles, he plays good defense, he hits spot up threes. And but I'm with you. I think people are expecting a little too much out of Damari in Toronto.
Yeah, he's going to be the highest paid player on their team, I think.
So that's crazy.
It obviously puts a little bit of a target on your back, at least with the fans. They're going to expect production when you're given that kind of contract. So,
yep.
I mean, I think he'll be able to adjust, because he's that hard of a worker. He'll get it eventually. But I just don't know. I don't see it working out as well for him as it did in Atlanta. But that was a good move by the Hawks. I like Bazemore and Paolo. Once Paolo gets back, I like them being in that. They can work in that three spot.
Yep.
They also got Justin Holiday. I think he has the potential. You know, a lot of people in Atlanta are already calling him, oh, he's the next Damari. He's the guy that we're gonna pluck out of nowhere and is gonna be great. He's not going to be that, but he's going to be a decent piece off the bench when you need him. Splitter. Yeah, I didn't mean to touch on Splitter yet. I was wary of the move a little bit at the time, because I always thought I don't know if we can retain Millsap now. But then I think the news came out like later that day that they were keeping Millsap, offered Millsap, and he agreed, which, you know, the moratorium works is all weird. You know, he'd agreed to it, and that was, you know, the trade was agreed to like a couple hours before that. But so it was like, oh crap, that must be Millsap's gone. And then it turned out 2 hours later, it's like, oh nope, we're gonna have all three of them. And now Atlanta really has a lot of options with what to do with their front court, because they can have Al and Splitter out there. They can have Paul and Splitter out there. You know, they can have Paul and Al out there. And they're all three very capable starting options. You know, Paul and Al are all-stars. Splitter's not an all-star talent, but he's definitely the best third big probably of almost any team.
Right. He's definitely a rotation big on any team, a quality team. And we saw he played for the Spurs. So,
yeah. He's a starting quality talent. He could be starting on a lot of teams. So the fact that they have him as his third big, and he can plug in probably about 24 minutes a game. because that was became a bit of a problem at the end of last year too, when Petr Antic went through his shooting slump, and they, you know, they had Mike Scott, which I guess it's another issue we'll talk about later, Mike Scott. But you know,
talk about Mike Scott. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, when both of those guys weren't shooting well, Perro could play defense, but Mike Scott is a dreadful defender. So if those guys weren't making shots, you know, you took out Paul or Al, and it's just like you're going to that, and it's such a drop-off on what you're getting. Now that you have Splitter, he's not going to be, you know, gunning like Perro and Mike Scott did at times, but he's going to do all the simple things that it won't be a drop-off. He's easy to plug in, and you can keep everything going. He knows the offense. So the fact that they got him and were able to keep Millsap in, or if they're just going to have a killer front court all 48 minutes, they're going to, I mean, they can plug in guys, you know, whichever matchup they want, it's going to be
right. Whoever has it going that night, you guys can just stay with them. If somebody doesn't have it going, you can sit him and give Splitter big minutes. It's a lot of versatility. I've even heard some talk of maybe playing Millsap at the three. What do you think about that?
I don't see that happening very often, if at all.
There you
mainly
go.
Mainly because, yeah, I know Millsap doesn't want to play the three. He can't guard the three. Like, a lot of people said, oh, well, he guarded LeBron. It's like, LeBron's not a three.
LeBron, exactly.
Yeah, it's like, he can't keep up with most threes. He doesn't want to be guarding most threes. It's a lot of ground to cover. That's not what that's not defensive assignments he's used to. So I think that they'll rarely see that. You might see it in a few sets that they run, you know, maybe single play sets out of timeouts or even stuff like that'll, you know, maybe if there's injury problems, they might have to go to that. But if everyone's healthy, I know they don't want to play that. There's no
right.
reason to play that. Unless they have injury problems, there's really no reason to be putting Millsap at the three because it's not a position he's comfortable with. And it's not really a position, I mean, what is your lineup at that point? Are you playing like T, Korver, like Millsap, Horford, Splitter? That's just an awkwardly positioned lineup. Paul and Al, you know, Paul can shoot, but it's not where he is going to be all the time. You just can't, you're just not going to spot Paul like in a corner because that's wasting Paul Millsap's offensive talent. You send Korver to spot up in a corner and run around screen and stuff because that's what he's good at. You don't tell Paul to like, hey, go sit in the corner, run around a screen or something because that's stupid. You want to get Paul near the basket, get him easy baskets where he can bully guys around with his size.
Okay,
so I don't think he'll put him at the three a lot.
You raise a very good point about the lineups and how's it going to go. So let's start. Let's fast forward a little bit. Who do you think is your starting five next year? Opening night.
Assuming everyone's healthy, or not assuming. Or,
we're not going to assume Tabo's healthy yet, because I think with his kind of injury, I have a feeling he's not going to be ready for the start of the year. So say Tabo's not quite ready yet.
I think it'll be T. Korver. I think Korver will be ready by the start of the season. Probably Kent Bazemore as a three, and then Millsap Horford. I think Bazemore proved that he's a guy that can sub in at that spot and produce. He's not going to be your starter throughout the year. But, you know, Tavolosius, or Tavolosius, I just said a neat word. Neek slips up and often calls Tavolosius, and it rubbed off on me. So Cephalosha is not going to be ready by then, but, you know, once Cephalosha is healthy, he's clearly a better option than Bazemore. He's a much better defender. He's a bigger defender. And he's a little more consistent on offense than Bazemore, but until then, I expect Bazemore to start at the three. And then you'll probably have Hardaway Jr. and Justin Holiday backing up sort of the 2-3 hybrid position where either can play depending on who else is in the lineup.
Hello? And the ghost hits again. That's crazy. Man, Blog Talk, you got to get together. Me and him, we're rolling too. So I'm going to get him to call back in.
All right.
Hello?
Yep.
Oh, hey. So I'm the one that got dropped. You didn't even get dropped.
No.
That's awesome.
I got on a tangent about Pablo Cephalosha for a second, and then no one responded. I was like, wait.
Oh, that's awesome. So, hey, that's great. Guess what? I get to hear the tangent for the first time like the listeners do when I replay the show. So, yeah, I'm not going to actually go into it all over again. Somehow my call got dropped, and I called in. So now you're the host, I guess. So you take charge.
I guess we can cut out that big silence. Can we cut out that big silence later?
It probably won't. How long was it?
About 30 seconds, probably.
Wow. All right, yeah. I don't know. I'll see. I need to get some editing tools and learn how to edit this stuff up. Okay, so either way, that was your starting lineup. My one thing with the Splitter acquisition was that you guys were so flexible everywhere, and that your starting front court is so dynamic, and he either wherever you put him, he either at the center, you know, with Horford or Millsap, he makes you guys a lot more conventional. But I know he's not going to be eating up huge minutes. So it's not that big a deal. And Splitter, I think I do underrate him. I know that. My thing is, if the Spurs are high on him, I should be a little more appreciative of him. But he seemed almost, I don't know, I wasn't the biggest fan of his. But everyone says that he's, you know, he can pass the ball and he won't gum up the offense and he's a smart player. So he's a good addition. Then let's talk about your first guy off the bench, Dennis Schroeder. Schroeder was one of my favorite players last season. I didn't watch too much Atlanta, but the kid is really dynamic. He's quick. He seems like I say, he's built like Rondo, but he's a lot better offensively. Seems like. What do you expect out of him going forward this year? If you gave him a report saying, "Hey, go work on this stuff this summer," what would that report have said? And what do you expect coming up out of him this next season?
It would have said in large bold letters, "Learn how to be a point guard." Big font, everything. Like 70, size 72 font, and just would have said that. He really got into it last year where he felt really comfortable being as an offense, as a scorer. And sometimes he just put his head down and that's all he tried to do was score. So he's got to learn to, you know, take a step back, you know, be able to learn to read a defense, be able to learn to run an offense actually as the point guard, not just go out there and try to score. Cause it was awful at times trying to watch him take on, you know, go in, put his head down and essentially be taking guys 1-on-3 and wouldn't be passing the ball at all. So
yeah,
he's just got to learn how, he's young still, you know, he's in a difficult offensive system to run in Atlanta, so it's not it will be difficult, but that's one thing he needs to really learn, take a step back, not try to, you know, get a layup every, you know, a layup for yourself every possession. And I think he'll get a little more time with the starters this year. I think that'll help a lot, you know, having Al and Paul with him a lot more, whereas, you know, last year he had a lot of, you know, Perro and Mike Scott at times. And of course, if you, you know, I like Perro and Mike Scott, but that, you know, if that's what you're going with, sometimes, you know, you might have to be the guy that's just running out there. And it's like, okay, I have to score because everybody else sucks right now. So, you know, just learning to be the offense, learning to find Kyle in the corner on transition plays. That was another thing that had really popped out towards the end of the season. He'd be going down the floor, Korver's wide open. He'd try to go to the bucket, and Korver's just sitting there like, hey, I was wide open. I'm Kyle
right.
Korver. Why didn't you pass me the ball? Come on, you're the point guard.
Yeah, he got a little tunnel vision sometimes, and I remember how awkward it was watching him in the playoffs, especially when you guys were, you know, you're down to the Heat, and I don't blame him. He wanted to help the team, but yeah, he started playing a little hero ball towards the end there.
Mm-hmm. Now, a couple times it worked. I think it was that game against Washington where the Hawks almost came back. I remember there was a game where he scored like 15 points in the fourth quarter.
Yep, I remember that. Yeah, he's an awesome talent.
Yeah, That was funny because the game, it was, I think it was that game, the announcers were talking about, you know, well, Atlanta just doesn't have a guy that can go out and score 10, 15 points in a quarter, and Dennis Schroeder goes out there and does it. I was laughing my ass off. So, that was one of my favorite parts of the season.
And you know what? That's the thing that you said. It's good you said that, because that kind of segues into the next thing I was going to ask you about. So much was made about how the Hawks were, you know, some of their parts, no real superstar. And that's kind of true, but I think Millsap and Horford are superstar or almost superstar level talents. I think they kind of sacrifice parts of their game for the betterment of the team. And also, I think that Jeff Teague is that unknown, and he's kind of knocking that level too, and we're not quite sure. What do you make of Jeff Teague, and where do you see him among the current crop of great point guards? Because I'll tell you my perspective first. I know he's really quick. He can't be stopped if he wants to get in the lane. His decision-making is getting a lot better. He runs that offense. When all the pieces are out there and they're moving and they're working, he does an excellent job when he's on. But I'm not quite sure if he has it in him to make that jump to that next level. Because, like, right now I think there's the top three. There's Curry, there's Chris Paul, and there's Russ. Then right below them, there's the Mike Conleys, John Walls.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know exactly where Jeff Teague is. Is he in that next second group? Can he possibly be in that group, or where do you see him? So you're talking a little bit about Jeff Teague and what he means to that offense.
You know, when you were, you know, sort of, you know, praising his game, you know, talking about all the things he's good at, that's things he can bring to the table. The problem is he doesn't always bring it to the table, it looks like. It looks like there's just games where he's just off. You know, he doesn't want to get into the lane. You know, he's just a little, like, almost like a step behind on his decision-making. So it's really, if he brought everything you just compliment him with him every game, he would be in that second tier with John Wall, Mike Conley, decisively. He can be there a lot of times. Look, you know, I see him go out there and he puts up, you know, like 21-8 rather easily.
Right.
Like, you know, you could do that more often, you know. But that's one thing he just has to get better at, is bringing it every game. It doesn't look like looks like sometimes he's a step behind. I don't know if he just gets tired sometimes, you know, season taking a toll on a player. But, you know, if he can really bring that with him consistently, he would definitely decisively put himself in that second level. There's no other further step after that for him at this point. He's 26. You know, he's not going to become a Steph Curry or Chris Paul at this point, but he can definitely be, he could definitely be, you know, we always talk about top whatever. He could definitely be a top 10 point guard. I think you could put him there now. But, you know, some people would disagree with that. I think there's still some left in him. He could decisively put himself there. And I think one step sort of we saw from that last season was he got a lot better at defense. He was just a much better defensive player in, you know, keeping up with guys, fighting through screens. Now, knowing what, you know, that's what we were talking about earlier, almost knowing where to be. It seems like he took a little step forward on that. That's another thing that he can improve on. So if he just ever, you know, sort of brings it together into that full package where he's bringing it every game and he has that with him every game, then that would definitely put him in that tier that you talked about behind, you know, behind the first three. So that's what I would like to see from him this season.
So Jeff Teague, if you're listening, which I know you're not, we want to see you be more consistent, and we want to see you step up your defensive intensity a little more. Does that sound about right?
Yep. And, you know, if he sees me, he'd probably tell me to, you know, whatever. But
yeah, who are we?
Yeah, he's a very laid-back guy. So sometimes it almost seems like he's, you know, all those things. Like, sometimes it's like, okay, you're being too laid-back now.
That's a
like
funny thing, because
where he's off. But
yes, demeanor plays a huge part into that kind of thing, because I think just from me watching and you've seen a lot more, he just seems to be such a, like you said, laid back. He has kind of sleepy eyes. He never seems to be, even when he's, you know, he's quick, but he never seems to be in a rush. So when he's having an off game, it probably looks like, dude, he's disinterested. But I'm pretty sure that's not the case. Like you said, you know, he needs to work on his consistency.
Yeah, I mean, there's told people, that, you know, people said, oh, he did, you know, you know, this guy, like, doesn't want to play. You know, they all want to play. They all, like, when they get in there, they're all trying. You know, that's when it's, oh, he's not trying. They're all trying. You know, then pro basketball players really never going out on the court not trying. Like, they're pro athletes. That's how they got there. So, I mean, it's just like sometimes they don't have it. Yeah.
So, yeah, some games you just do not have it, and that's how it is. But, yeah, I really like it. It's so crazy. Like, last year, I thought it was kind of cheesy when they made the whole Hawks starting five, the player of the week, whatever. But, I mean, it kind of – no, I mean, it is what it is, because the team was better than the sum of its parts, and no one really stood out. So, who would you say is the best player for the Atlanta Hawks? Who was that guy?
Al Horford.
And, really?
Okay. Like, I would say that every day, at least right now. I mean, some people, I think, would say Millsap. I think it's Al Horford by a little bit. He's a better defender to me. A little bit more consistent than an offensive player. I mean, they're both great defenders, great offensive players, but for me, it's just like Horford always seems like a little bit ahead of them. God, they're both really good at everything. Great passes.
They really are.
You know? Yeah. They complement each other so well.
How many centers would you take in front of Al Horford right now? Well, first of all, let me ask you this, because I always hear this debate. And I hate this debate because it seems kind of silly, because I think he's been playing center, I mean, almost his whole career, but people are saying, oh, he's really a power forward. So what do you consider him?
Oh, he's a center.
Thank you.
It's ridiculous. Leading. I think I've been the number one charge on, like, Al Horford's a center. Shut up with this power forward talk. You know, he could play power forward, but that's not the position he's playing. And he's playing center very well. There's no reason to talk about it. Like, when people say, oh, he would be better at power forward. Well, he's already really, really good. How much better would he really be, you know, playing next? I think Millsap's almost a perfect complement for him. A guy that can also stretch the floor. You know, they allow each other to work inside and out. You know, if Horford's down out, you know, there's not anybody blocking his way to the basket, which is, I think it was 2 years ago now, people saying, like, oh, they should have traded Paul Millsap to Houston for Omer Asik. And I was like, Omer Asik can't catch a basketball. You know, he can't do anything on offense.
That would be one of the most one-sided trades I've ever heard in my life. And that would be did people really say that?
Yeah, that's because when Millsap signed his, like, cheapo contract, people were assuming, like, it was supposed to be, like, some sign-and-trade or something to Houston for Asik. And I was like, that's stupid.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, but, you know, that would have turned I've said this about LaMarcus Aldridge before, that would have turned, you know, Al Horford into LaMarcus Aldridge on offense for no reason, you know, putting up shots from mid-range because he doesn't have the room to go inside.
Right.
And, you know, it's really inefficient. It's really not what you want him doing, considering he can be such an effective force close to the basket. And Asik is just not an offensive force in any imagination of the word. So, yeah, that's all from my opinion. Yeah, Al Horford's the center, and he's also the best player on the Hawks, in my opinion.
So how many centers in the league right now do you take above Al Horford?
That is a good question. Probably, I would say Mark Gasol would be one.
Mm-hmm.
Probably Dwight, too, if he's healthy. And maybe DeMarcus Cousins.
There you go.
That might be it.
I wouldn't disagree at all, because I think people look at Al's numbers. Last season, he was at 15 points a game and 7 rebounds, a little over a block a game. And again, I really feel that so much of who he is masked by those numbers, because he does. I mean, they all sacrifice touches. They move the ball. They play within that offense. I think on another team, you would see, you know, you'd see 18 and 9 from him every night. He's that good. The face-up game, the post-up game, he's a smart player. It's criminal almost how underrated he is.
Mm-hmm. He's really good. Anybody's listening to this podcast doesn't know, he's really good.
I love him. And then let's talk about it. Him and Millsap together for the last couple of years have been – well, this is the only year where we haven't seen him because he was hurt the year before. But together, they're, you know – they're one of the more productive front courts in the league, and one of the most versatile front courts in the league. And to me, they're one of the most talented. And I asked this on Twitter a couple of times, who, you know, what front court would you take? And people keep saying Marc Gasol and Zebo, and that's great. What do you think of them as a front court? What makes them? What puts them above the other front courts to you? Where do you rank them, first of all? And then what makes them so special?
Oh gosh, off the top of my head, I don't know where I'd rank them. But if you want me to like go off, like if I had to pitch them as the best, why would I pitch them as that?
Yeah, let's go with that.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah. Okay. So there are two guys that can both spread the floor. They can sort of both really play interchangeably on defense. Millsap's strong enough to guard most centers in the league. You know, Horford has been defending centers his whole life, regardless of what people think on Twitter. They can both play inside. Both extremely smart passers. You don't see really many front courts that have two talented passers like that. I think a lot of people will say Chicago is better than them, but I don't. At this point in Gasol's career, and I'm just not that huge on Noah as a passer as everybody else is, despite his statistics that he's put up. They're both really good at everything. That's, you know, the best way I can come up with it. They can both shoot. They can both play near the basket. They both can play great individual defense and team defense. They know where to be on defense. They know where to be on offense. And they both seem like guys that are, you know, they're really smart. They're not really combative. They're sort of, you know, sort of low key. They're not really guys that are hot-headed that will be team disruptive. So, you know, if I was pitching them, it's like, this is why you should take that. You know, that's, they're both really good at practically everything you would ask for as of a basketball player. Like, you can put them on anywhere on the floor and you can be comfortable with them on both offense and defense.
Completely agree. It's not so much that they're great at any one thing, but as far as basketball players, they're really great all around. What do you say to the criticism of the Hawks that they do need somebody who can go out and, like the announcer said, on any given night give you 25? They need a quote-unquote alpha dog. It's funny because I could see both sides of that, especially the way the playoffs ended. But, again, context. The playoffs ended that way for a reason. And, I mean, no one says that about the Spurs, you know, and the Spurs have done it for years. So, it's like, I don't like that argument. I mean, because again, that would make the Hawks more traditional. But what do you feel about that whole line of thinking?
I get it. I get the idea. It's like, okay, when, you know, and things are going tough for you, when people aren't making shots, you need someone that can just go out there and get buckets for you. I get that argument, but I don't think it has to be that way. I get why it would need to be that way for a lot of teams, because I don't think, you know, that a lot of teams have the system and the talent and the intelligence. Atlanta's a really smart team. I think we were talking about this when Mike Budenholzer first came in as a coach. People are saying, oh, they've got a bunch of really smart players, but you know, what is that? I mean, this isn't, you know, an IQ test. This is basketball. You know, does that mean anything? I think we found out, okay, you know, having smart players actually is, you know, very much a positive for your team in terms of on the basketball court production. So I think both can work. I won't think Atlanta needs to go out there, but I get someone saying it's like, okay, maybe things aren't going, you need one, but like I get the argument, but I don't think it's necessary to have the one guy. I think you can focus it and your team can contribute. I like the idea of, you know, go out there and get the easiest bucket every time. I think that's also a strategy to giving it to the best player. I think both can be effective.
I will say that I kind of was watching, the one I did watch last year, I was thinking there were times maybe that Coach Bud could maybe call Millsap or Jeff Teague's number a little more. Because you do, I think Jeff Teague and Millsap both have that ability in them to, if needed to, ISO up and get things done. Or, you know, put Millsap on the box and let him work. And I understand your offense was a kind of a free-flowing, ball-movement, sharing offense. But I was wondering do you agree with that? Maybe there were times when, all right, so we're struggling a little bit on offense. Let's call a couple sets and get Millsap the ball in the middle of the lane. Am I right or wrong with that?
Yeah, I think they saw that as Teague and Millsap are probably the best isolation options they have on the team. Both have a really great first step off the perimeter, and Paul can post up too. That obviously helps. there were plays like that. I think that, you know, they thought that a lot of times. I know, I can't remember what game it was where Millsap just had like this massive, and I think it was against Denver. Millsap was just eating up for Reed, and they just kept going back to him and back to him and back, you know, it tried other things, and, you know, the offense would slow down a little bit. So he's like, all right, give it back to Millsap, you know, but that definitely happened. I mean, that definitely happened where they looked for them in isolation, and they got the job done sometimes. And then, you know, the limitations of them as isolation players, that wasn't always the best offense. So I think that, you know, they can go to that if they need to. Like, it's like, okay, we need, like, I guess, you know, gun to your head, you have 5 seconds left to get a bucket. You're saying, okay, one person has to go up there. I think they can do that. But I think I think they're better off continuing to, you know, pass the ball the way that they usually do in Budenholzer's system.
I agree 100%, man. It's more, I mean, that's one of the quote-unquote blessings and a curse with the system is that, you know, it makes you successful. But then, you know, after a full season of it, you know, you can't just switch up in the middle of the playoffs. That's what people were saying in the playoffs when, I mean, hey, Korver was out, so that killed your spacing. Carroll mm-hmm. was hampered. People were still questioning, oh, why isn't he doing that? They're a finely tuned machine that's missing two key cogs right now. There's nothing much you can really do about that.
Continuing off that, but it's like, you know, they're missing two key cogs. It takes a while to learn how to work without those. And the playoffs isn't that time. You don't have that time. and that's exactly. Why it just broke down.
Exactly. High pressure situation. The other team is seeing you every day and scouting everything you do. If you are not 100%, then it means you're almost food. So it's what happens. So I told Twitter you were coming on, and I asked him any questions. You want to answer a couple questions?
Sure. Let's go for it.
All right. From our friend at Tim Donahue, 8P9S. You know Tim Donahue. He writes for 8.9 Second. He mm-hmm. asked, what's your position on the quote, you are what your record says you are, unless you're the Hawks. Then you're just the Hawks. So kind of what we talked about earlier. No, and it's, hey, you know what? The Hawks have earned a very bad reputation because, like I said, almost a decade of mediocrity.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
So talk to me about when you hear people say, like, oh, well, they're just the Hawks. How does that make you feel about the current teams?
I guess I get that perception. Like you sort of said, you know, they were media. So I get that perception. It's like, oh, you know, the Hawks are looking well. Yeah, it's almost Atlanta, you know, living in Atlanta. It's almost Atlanta sports when everything seems to be going right. You know, they crap up in the playoffs. The Braves made a living out of doing that for 2 decades. So,
yeah.
I mean, and the Hawks have too. Even when they had Dominique in the late 80s and early 90s, they never reached that next level despite how many wins they had. They had 57, you know, they were mid-50s win team with Dominique several times. You know, they, you know, he ran into the Celtics and then he ran into Jordan, and it just, like, I guess that's what a lot of people would see now. It's like, oh, you know, the Hawks may win 60 games, but they're going to run into a team with the best player around it at some point and just fall apart.
Yeah,
so
but
I don't think it's fair, but I get why someone would say that. But I mean, they won 60 games. I mean, how many teams won 60 games last year? Two.
Exactly. Yeah. My thing with that is, it's been a complete regime change since the mid 2000s. You know, everything's changed. Joe Johnson's gone. Josh Smith is gone. A new ownership. New GM, everything's changed. So when people start doing that, it's kind of it's one of those Twitter cliches, or I guess even sports cliches, the same way that sometimes people are even now saying LeBron has no clutch gene and some nonsense like that. Nobody cares about that stuff except for the Skip Bayless kind of crowd, you know. So that's one of those things. But it's and until you guys, I think, until the Hawks make a really good showing as far as even if they battle and go down in 6-7 games to a team in the Eastern Conference Finals. Until that happens, I think it's going to kind of follow you guys around. It is what it is,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, at one point, you know, 61 seasons don't pop out of nowhere, but at some point you also have to prove that you're a contender. And they had their chance last season, but injuries just took it from them. So I guess we're, we just have to wait and see again. See what they can do again. You know? So,
hey, thanks, Tim. Hope you listen in and we gave you your answer here. A question from at @ATL_COYB. What's that? ATL underscore coach of the year. Bravo. I don't know what it means. Bigger problem, losing DeMar or the Korver/Cabo injury uncertainties. So what's going to affect you guys more going forward, the fact that DeMar is gone or the fact that Korver and Cabo are both coming back with question marks?
I'm going to say DeMar being gone. I think that's a bigger, you know, issue to address. But they also kind of go hand in hand. You're trying to address Damari leaving with Korver and Cabo, and both of them are injured right now. But I think they'll bounce upcoming season. The bigger issue will be that Damari is not there. And Damari was a stalwart. He was, you know, a classic, you know, became a classic 3-and-D guy. That's all, you know, he would spot up, make threes, and play as hard as hell on defense. So I think until, you know, Cabo is going to have to get a touchback on offense at some point.
Right, it's almost like chicken or the egg, right? Because if Cabo and Korver come back healthy, that kind of diminishes how much you're hurt by DeMar being gone. But then if they don't come back 100% healthy, then the question is going to be like, wow, they have nobody really stepping up a small forward on the wings. So it's almost like they like you said, they go hand in hand. One depends on the other one.
There's one point I want to make too with that. A lot of people, you know, especially at the end of the season, a lot of people said, oh, Damari Carroll is the most important defensive player on the Hawks. He's the best defensive player on the Hawks. That wasn't true. It was true after the NYPD broke Cabo's ankle. Before that, Cabo was the best defensive player on the Hawks. So you can see that in every sort of statistical representation, how much better the Hawks were on defense with Cabo on the court. It's ridiculous to a certain point. He was just so good. Not to take away from Damari because he's really good too, but it's just like, and then you see this with Cabo coming in, and it just got so much better. The offense just wasn't completely there, but yeah, losing Cabo to injury was a big issue last season. If he can come back, I think that erases a little bit of what Damari's leaving impact was.
Yeah, I don't think the casual fan who just kind of watched, you know, oh, winning streak, I don't think they understood how, you know, they haven't seen Cabo and what he did in OKC because they're just casual fans, right? So they didn't understand how important he is to a team's defense. Not only could he, you know, guard individually, one-on-one, anyone he'd give up, he'd probably do just as good a job on LeBron or even Durant as anyone else could. No one can stop either one of them, but he can do the job. And how much he meant to the team defense. I think fans understand what a high-quality defender he is. Speaking of Korver, too. I was going to say, speaking of Korver, too, so Korver's getting a little older, and he had a career year last year. What's the likelihood of him repeating that? What do you think going forward we see from that? Because I understand why he was an all-star. He was excellent, but he's such a unique player that he needs so much else to happen for him to be effective. You know, the screens and everyone else has to be doing their part. It was such a symbiotic relationship with him and the rest of the Hawks that it's hard to gauge his true level of play, if you understand what I'm saying. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, he shot almost 50% for three. He was over 50% for most of the season. I mean, I just don't, you know, if you're telling me he predicts his shooting percentage for this year, I'm like, well, he's not doing that because that's just ridiculous. I also thought the year before him shooting 47% from three was ridiculous. So it's not impossible for him to replicate it, but I think we'll take a step back a little bit. I mean, he's getting older, and, you know, he keeps shooting for a while, but I mean, I just think last year he was just so insane with his shooting at certain times. I can't safely predict a player to do that again. It's just like sometimes when, Steph Curry gets really on fire, it's like, oh, there's no way he can, you know, do that again. That was ridiculous. And I think that's sort of, you know, the level Korver was at last season. It's like, how do you shoot better than that? I mean, you could make more shots, but.
he's 34 already. Not concerned, of course. I think he takes care of himself. From what I understand, his off-season workouts are pretty insane. So I'm not going to say concerned, but what do you expect from him this year as far as minutes, production? Can you project out for him a little bit?
I think it'll be similar to his past, I guess, three seasons in Atlanta now. You know, playing probably a little over 30 minutes, assuming he's healthy, probably. You know, you shoot for, you know, somewhere between, you know, like 12 points a game, 45% three-point shooting around that area. I mean, the key component for him is to be on the floor for those 30 minutes. He doesn't always have to make a shot, but if he, you know, if he's out there, you can tell the difference just from him being out there, even if he's not shooting. You got to guard him. You can't leave him open.
Yeah. The buzzword last season was gravity, and a lot of that had to do with him because, you know, we talked a lot about how much respect defenders had to give him just because of who he was. Because if you turned your head for a split second and gave him half a foot, he's draining a 3-point in your face. So that means so much to you guys. Yeah, that means that's huge.
And
to you guys
started dunking last season.
Hey, you know what though? It's funny because I talked about this. I was a pro Atlanta guy last year because people were saying, "Oh, he just shoots and does nothing else," and that's not quite true. He's a really good team defender. I noticed every game, at least once a game, usually twice, I would see him go and get a really tough rebound. He'd come down out of a crowd, you know, a rebound that you wouldn't think Kyle Korver would get. So he's not scared to get in there. He had a lot of sneak blocks. A guy would think he was shooting.
Yeah,
those
are always fun. Yeah.
Right. And he sometimes head up. You know, the guys are going to just jump shoot over Korver. Nope, he'd go up and get it, or he'll come behind you and swat it. So he's a sneaky good defender. He's just not very athletically gifted.
To a lot of people, I don't think they expect Kyle Korver to be as big as he is. He's like 6'7", 6'8". He's got long arms. So I think, you know, it's like, oh, I'm just going to take this, you know, old white guy off the dribble. And it's like, nope, can't, because he's just so big. He has good footwork. I mean, that's all he works on with how he, you know, gets around screens and sets for shots. That's almost all he works on is footwork. So he, you know, uses the same thing defensively. So I just don't think people expect them. It's like, oh, he's huge and he, you know, he's able to stay in front of me. I don't think a lot of players expect that. You know, a lot of fans don't expect him to be able to do that either. Cause you know, they assume it's like, oh, here's old white guy out there. That's exactly what it is.
It's the white basketball player, stereotype. It is. They think white basketball player, you know, a good shooter, and that's pretty much it. But no, I was impressed. I really got into it with some guy on Twitter where I even got into it, but he just kept saying, at first I didn't see much of a difference other than Kyle Korver being a better shooter between Korver and Dunleavy Jr. And the guy kept telling me, he was like, no, Kyle Korver is a way better player. And I still think he's a way better player. I think he's more important to what Atlanta did than what Dunleavy did in Chicago. But that shooting makes a huge difference, and Korver is definitely better than I thought he was the more I watched him last season. He brings a lot more to the table than just being able to shoot.
We're about to get into the white guy basketball player, Ed, because they're good shooters, smart, all those white guy adjectives.
I mean, it's sad, but it's true. And also, it's weird the fact that when you do compare basketball players, right, some guy comes in the league, you don't, if he's a white kid, you don't really compare him to other, you want to compare him to other white players.
That's what happens in every draft. You know, player comes out, I mean, any, you, this isn't even just, you know, white and black players either. It's, you know, people from, you know, foreign countries, you know, saying it's like, oh, okay, compare him to this other person that came from that country before him.
Yep.
So,
weird.
You know, you don't.
That...
Yeah, so.
I mean, let's think about it. Can you think of a good comparison? Adam Morrison, a good comparison that's not white. I can't. I actually tried to do this myself, and I was trying to come up with good comparisons, and it's weird that it's kind of hard to do.
It is. I mean, there is a reality to those. To the white guy adjective thing. I mean, there's different skill sets. That's what the way players come up. But Adam Morrison, that is like the worst example.
All right, how about this one? Let's go back.
Who's another terrible player?
Let's go back a little bit. Do you remember Bob Sura? Or is that before your time? That might be before your time.
That's before my time, yeah.
Man, you made me feel old. Man, we're not going to dig too deep in this. We're not going to get to the sociological aspect of comparing players too much. Let's talk about your squad. Let's go back to the Hawks. All right, so where do you? So last year you guys shot to the top of the charts with a bullet, and then you kind of stumbled a little bit down the end, but you had such a big lead that you held on to the number one seed. This year, everyone's going to see you coming. It's not going to be so much a surprise. You had some roster turnover. You're going to be integrating pieces. How do you see the season going? And we know that right now the Cavs are the favorite in the East. Where do you think you guys stack up with the East elite?
If anybody's expecting Atlanta to win 60 games again, I don't think that's going to happen. But I still think they're in that top tier in the East. That 50 wins better team in the East is really where that is. I think there'll be a slow start to the season. And, we'll have the sort of the same thing. Oh, here comes Atlanta. They're lagging behind again. What a surprise. But, slow start to the season. There is some roster turnover. We still have no idea where Korver and Tava will be health-wise. So there might be some, trying to fill some gaps at the start of the season. So it'll start slow. But I think, by the end of the season, they'll be just as good as they were last year. In terms of production, probably be, around 52 wins. So I think they're definitely in that upper tier. I don't know if they can compete with the Cavs again, but I definitely think they could give them a run for their money.
What
game series, I think it would go 7, but I don't know if they'd win it.
Okay, so now here's the question. They install you as GM for a week, and you have the full keys. What, if any, moves do you see that you can make that would put you into the upper tier of league contenders? What do you think is missing, or what do you think? You think just needs more time to coalesce, a couple more years of continuity? Do you think is there a move you see out there, a player you think could be brought in to put you guys over the top? What do you think we're missing?
I think the start, if you got to my starting lineup, middle of the season, you see you have T, Korver, Tabo, Paul, and Al out there as your starting lineup. They're fully healthy, trade deadline's coming. It's like you have to make a move. I think you're looking for more consistent production from the bench. That's what it came to in the playoffs last year. It's like, okay, the Hawks couldn't play the bench. The bench just fell apart in the playoffs. I know Mike Scott was a little hurt his back in April, and he was supposedly healthy by then. I don't think he was because he was dreadful in the playoffs. Perro was sort of good sometimes, and he's all on and off others. And then, we talked about Schroeder. We talked about sometimes he put his head down a little too much, and it was a detriment to the team. So I'm not sure if I'd say, I want to go out and get this guy, but that's definitely what I'd look at. I'd look at, maybe wings, bench wings. I mean, you have some. You have Bazemore. You have Justin Holiday probably coming off the bench. You have Hardaway. And maybe Hardaway could develop into that guy, and that's what they were looking for. But that's definitely what I look at. I was like, I need someone consistent on sort of both sides of the ball on the bench. They don't have to be really great, but someone that's like, I can plug in and trust for 5 minutes. We might only need him for 5 minutes, but it's like, I feel comfortable with this guy on the floor for 5 minutes.
So let's run down a little bit. Would you want a guy like Lou Will back?
No. And there's a reason the Hawks got rid of Lou Will is because he couldn't defend at the level he was required. He's a small dude. He's 6'1", trying to defend shooting guards a lot, and that just didn't work. And he's sort of the same thing with what Schroeder did. It's, he's a guy that puts his head down a lot and tries to go get buckets.
And that's his job. That's fine. That's his job. But
that's his job. That's his job, and he's good at it. That's his job, and he's good at it. But that's not the way the Hawks play.
Yeah, the thing about him and Jamal Crawford that I think it's funny how many guys that I think in the early 2000s would be big stars and well loved, and they're still loved, and they're still the fans love them. But it's as we get more and more analytic driven. I mean, is it good to have a guy come off the bench and shoot 40% to get and take 14 shots to get 14 points? Is it? And they don't defend, they don't defend, they don't rebound. Him and Jamal Crawford and Nick Young are those kind of players. And I guess on a really good team, they can be useful in spurts. You know, somebody come off and if they hit their first two shots, let them run. But the fact that, you know, Lou Will is playing, I don't know, 20-something minutes, and Jamal Crawford comes in and gets big minutes and has a lot of responsibility, I think that kind of that's indicative of one of the problems their teams have, because you're just giving the guy a ball and say, hey, go get us buckets. And that's not really – if they're not really good bucket getters, then it kind of negates the purpose.
Even with, you know, Crawford and Lou Will who sort of made that their niche, there's only so long you can go with those guys too.
Exactly. You don't want to give them too much.
Yeah, they are hot and cold players. Sometimes they can give you 10 points in a quarter, and sometimes they'll give you 10 shots in a corner and 4 points.
Exactly. Can't give them too long.
That type of player can be effective going off where, you know, Jamal Crawford played here for 2 years. His first year here, he was excellent. He shot extremely well, and he was definitely a contributor, even though, you know, he wasn't a defender off the bench, but he was so good offensively off the bench. You know, playing against those bench guys, he was able to, you know, change the way teams were forced to defend the bench unit because they had this guy, you know, start almost, you know, the starting caliber scorer and with the bench guys. So, I mean, there is some value in that, but, well, I mean, with the way the Hawks play right now, I don't know if there's a guy like that that's good enough at doing that because, you know, Jamal's tailed off a little bit as he's gotten older, and Lou Will was never as good as Jamal was anyway.
Exactly. We're talking about, because you're talking about when he was in Atlanta, that's 4, almost 5 years ago now. So it's you know, he's gotten older. And yeah, there was a time when, there you go. So there was a time when, you know, yeah, his first year in Atlanta, he shot almost 45% off the bench and 38% from three. And then look at him this year with the Clippers, he shot less than 40% from the floor and, you know, less than 33% from three. So his diminishing returns as he gets a little older. So can you give me an example of this a type of player, a certain guy, Deion Waiters?
Oh, no. It's got to be someone. Oh, gosh. And see, this is what it's hard to describe because there's probably a lot of people that would have heard me describe that and say, well, you just described probably who's someone, a starter. You know, someone that's consistent, that can do consistent on offense and defense. It's like, well, that's probably a starter on a lot of teams. And I get, yeah. But that's what I would be looking for, sort of those a fringe starter. Maybe I'm trying to even think. Much of that, it's weird to say it almost at this point. The way Gerald Green played last year was ridiculous.
Really?
I don't know if he fits that role of the defensive guy I'm looking for, but you know, sort of that kind of range.
Maybe you mean Gerald Green 2 years ago. He kind of regressed last year. Gerald Green wasn't too good last year.
He did, but he was still in terms of what you're going to get. I mean, if you're trying to get a bench guy, like I said, that's about the range of player you're going to get for. I mean, he's better than Deion Waiters. At least in my opinion, Gerald Green's better than Deion Waiters.
And make no mistake, to me, both of them, I mean, I think Gerald Green is not a very good NBA player. I think Deion Waiters is not a regular NBA player, but for different reasons. Deion at least tries defensively. He's just kind of a fool on offense, that stupid step back, and he takes a really bad shot. Gerald Green doesn't really play defense.
Yeah. He's big, though. I don't know. That's really – I'll straight up admit, it's like, this is why I'm not a GM.
Okay. I will
say about Deion Waiters, since I always trash on him, I still think that guy has the size, straight up size, to be a productive player. He is huge. I mean, he's only 6'4" in height, but that dude is jacked. I remember seeing him. I was like, is that really Deion Waiters? That guy looks like a WWE wrestler. Is how many muscles he has?
He's like a tank, right? My problem with him is, when is he gonna? I mean, so many guys have all the physical tools. Can he put it together and mentally get his game together? Because physically, I think physically he's almost a prototypical power guard, right? And he's athletic and he is, you know, good bounce, everything. But why are you taking a step back 18 footers, man? What are you doing?
Yeah, and maybe I guess you could say you saw the same. You know, the Hawks sort of saw that thing with Hardaway. It's like, all right, here's a guy. He's big. He's been in terrible systems his whole career. Maybe if we can, you know, we have the system where we'll put him in spots to succeed, and he will, because that's his only choice. you know, it won't be like on the Knicks where Tim Hardaway is like, all right, you can shoot because there's, I mean, we're terrible and there's nothing else we can do about it. So, I can still see a lot from those players, but that's what I would look for. It's like if Tim Hardaway doesn't become that guy, but that's like the sort of player I'm looking for. Someone off the bench is really, I think, what Atlanta needs that can be sort of that. I don't want to say that like Damari Carroll, because obviously he was a starter, but almost like a bench version of Damari Carroll.
So kind of versatile, kind of fill in jack of all trades kind of guy.
Yeah, a guy can come in and just fill in. He's not going to notice a lot, but you know, to the trained eye, you can see he's doing quite a bit.
So something we didn't
maybe Justin Holiday or Tim Hardaway can be that guy.
I like Justin Holiday. I like Justin Holiday, and I'm optimistic about the Hawks. I think that the combination of Justin Holiday, Tim Hardaway Jr., and Tabo would somehow cobble together enough production, and they'll kind of figure out which of those two guys are the best. And I think they won't miss Damari too much. I think they're gonna miss him not too much. But here's the thing that I'm gonna ask you about. So much of what Atlanta did was about chemistry. You guys really kind of bonded, and you guys seen the team seem to really get along, very harmonious. Then this offseason happened, and, you know, even started when Tabo got hurt. Tabo got hurt with that incident with the New York police, which was a real weird incident, and I'm pretty sure the investigation is still ongoing, and from what I understand, the players' union might be actually having some legal actions against the NYPD. Then Coach Bud got the DUI, the DOI thing going on with him. Mike Scott has a real big thing. I mean, I guess he's up with Fed charges right now. I wonder, looking at it now, right, that sounds like a pretty rough offseason. Do you see going forward these things affecting next season? How does this affect the team as a whole? Talk to me a little bit about the offseason, the incident so far, and am I blowing them out of proportion as a fan looking, or do you think they really can impact how this team will perform next year?
Well, the Budenholzer DUI thing was from 2013, I believe, 2014.
Oh, that's all.
It was literally like a couple of weeks after he was hired, and I don't think he was ever convicted of anything.
Got it.
If I remember correctly, with Mike Scott, I mean, you're right, chemistry is really important. I think a lot of people made fun of the Hawks because they traded Adrian Payne at the same time Tabo got hurt the first time.
Mm-hmm.
He strained a calf in late January and was out for a month before coming back. And then, you know, the NYPD, they traded Adrian Payne around that same time that he first got hurt. And a lot of people were like, oh, they messed up the chemistry. That's why, you know, they're going on this, you know, bit of like a 500 skid through February after going, you know, undefeated in January. And it's like, no, it's because Tabo's hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But that chemistry is important. I think the Mike Scott thing could be a bigger deal because I have no idea how long that's going to hang over the team. And of course, you know, it's with some of those guys, they've been around each other for several years. That's probably an uncomfortable experience for them too. And, you know, they never know if is he going to be back? Is he going to be able to practice? Is he going to go to jail for 5 years? So that could leave a cloud, but I don't know if it'll be that much to make a huge difference. And I think that's the other thing is how long Tavo's case against the NYPD lasts, which I don't know. That might almost have the reverse effect where they're trying to bond with the players. So I have no idea. I really have no idea how to would expect that with these incidents. They're really awkward. It's for a team to be going through in terms of criminal issues. Cause I mean, most of the time it's just, I mean, these are just weird issues that might get caught with, the drugs that could, you know, they're saying, oh, he could face up to 20 years. He's not going to get that, but it's definitely a big, you know, it's not like a small, he got caught with weed incident.
Right.
And
should they cut ties with Mike Scott?
Probably. I mean, I've been saying they should dump Mike Scott before the incident because he's not a very great talent, but
if they get a chance to do that, they absolutely should. And then I don't even think that's from a legal perspective as much as if they can take an opportunity and use it to cut his contract. So that's how I feel about that. But
I think these are just weird incidents for him to really be going through.
Okay, so what's your, give me your overall feeling then going into next season. What do you think? What's your, in one word, what's your emotional, I guess, or mental state about the team going into next season?
Optimistic. I'm definitely optimistic. It's good to see, you know, the team did well last season. I'd be very happy to see what they can do with another year with the system, with most of the same players. So it's going to be fun. I think, and that's something a lot of Atlanta, I said this earlier, but that's something a lot of Atlanta fans haven't been able to say a while about the Hawks. They're going to be fun. They're going to be good. They're going to be fun. And from, you know, the looks at the end of the last season, the crowd's going to be behind them, and it's going to be a fun experience just to, you know, just to go to games. So,
I'm looking forward to it. Yep. I'm looking forward to it. And I think it's funny how, again, the casual fans, a lot of them have already turned on Atlanta. You know, they had a great season. And that was cool. But a lot of people did the whole, watch the playoffs. They're going to collapse again. And they don't care about the context of it. And so now they feel like, see, same old Atlanta. I'm with you. I'm excited to see what they do. I think they're going to prove a lot of people wrong again this year. I think, you know, a lot of people are still trying to, I'm seeing projections of them, you know, being the bottom half of the East. I can't see it, you know, not with the talent they have. So I'm going to be with you on the, I'm with you on the bus, man. I'm with you on the bus for them. Who do you think will be the your team MVP this year?
Ooh, probably Horford. I think I already said, I think he's the best player on the team. And I guess that really qualifies for, I guess you could probably say Damari last year as the MVP. I guess you could make a case for Court.
Okay.
I think, you know, a lot of people called him that glue guy that held everything together. And I think there were a couple games where he was out where we sucked. Some people like made that point more, but I think Horford's the best player. Also think he's the most valuable. I think he impacts the team a lot, both in and out of the locker room. So I'd have to go with Horford.
Who do you think is that guy that kind of breaks out for you guys this year? No, not so we already know who the main players are. Who do you think really rises his game to another level and makes himself known this year? Either the new guys or the guys who've already been there.
I'm going to say Kent Bazemore. He's going to get a lot of time at the beginning of the season. He's going to have a lot of chances to prove himself. He seems to be a hard worker. He seemed to be taking hold in the system last year. You know, his shot started getting better. His defense was getting better in terms of he just wasn't trying to, you know, be athletic on every play and stay in front of guys where he's learning where to be. But I think, you know, those first few games of the season, if he's, you know, asked to start, I think he'll really prove himself as, you know, like that kind of capable guy who can be a starter on a team. I don't know if he should be, you know, especially when Tyler comes back. I think he'll definitely step his game up to where it's like, hey, this is a guy that's important to the team. He wasn't that guy last year. So I think it would be a big leap to say, like, hey, this guy's a big rotational guy. He's an important piece on this team.
Okay. So go ahead and give me that final prediction. Where do you think they finish in the East? We won't hold you to it. I'm totally going to hold you to it.
earlier I said, like, you know, low 50 wins, so anywhere, you know, between, like, 52, 54 wins.
Okay.
They'll probably be about, you know, third or so in the East. They'll be back in the top, you know, top half of the East. And I think they'll look like a team that has an opportunity to make the Eastern Conference Finals again. I don't think it'll be last year. We could say, like, okay, this could be – I don't think they'll be the teams like, hey, this could be the team that go all the way, but I think they could definitely be another team that at least contends in the East. And isn't seen as a fake contender, isn't he? So, like, a legitimate – this team's a threat. And that's a big step for the Hawks to say, like, okay, this team's a threat. Like, we have to take them seriously. I think that's where they'll be this season.
I agree. I think it's tough that you guys are playing in the time of LeBron, because I think for the next maybe at least next year and probably the year after, you know, the Cavs are just they're just fully loaded and they're gonna make it really tough to come out of the East. But I think Atlanta's right there with the Wizards, right there with I think maybe with Miami too, I guess, if Miami's healthy. They're right there as those kind of teams that are next tier below Cleveland. And I every time I see them play Cleveland, I hope they win, because it's a stylistic like win for the basketball purists, you know, the team play and elevating your teammates over the individual skill of LeBron James. I'm always going to pull for the underdog in that case.
Yeah, I mean, it's just fun to see. I think this is really one of the best times to watch basketball, because you see a bunch of different styles still. You see, like, you know, any time you can watch it, two different, most teams are shooting threes more now, and probably some people see that as the same thing, but it's really not. And a lot of teams have a bunch of different styles, and we get to see really which one is like, all right, the team prevailed because they could do this better, and they plan to do that better. That's I think, something that's really fun to watch.
Outside of Atlanta, give me your three teams you're excited to see this year.
Golden State, because they're stupid. Their execution is just stupid. They're so fun to watch, too. Because they're one of those teams that can do a little bit of everything that's entertaining to everybody. And it's just, if you're a basketball, you know, purist sort of like we are, they're just so fun to watch. Golden State, probably Miami, because I want to see how that works out with what they have. If they can get like a healthy season. And I'd be happy to see Chris Bosh back. Third team, probably Utah.
Nice.
They sort of came on strong at the end of last season. I want to see if that was real or not, if they can actually continue improving. They have a bunch of young players. They have a bunch of good young players. So it'd be interesting to see if they can keep improving and actually become, you know, sort of almost what like the Pelicans were the last 2 years. They're that team that you can clearly see is rising. You know, the Pelicans are going to be fun to watch too, but I'm interested to see if Utah can actually complete, you know, that jump from the cellar into a playoff team in the West, and that's not an easy jump to make.
Not at all. Excellent choices you got there. What rookie are you most looking forward to seeing?
Towns. I don't know. I mean, I'm really. That's it. That's a difficult question. I've been so focused on Atlanta. It's like, which rookie? It's like, oh man, who's on which team again? And.
No, I like the Towns choice, man. I think Towns gonna really, really show out. I like his size. I like his versatility. I like his fit with his team. So I think I personally am looking more forward to Moutier because he's such an unknown. But I saw a little flash of his talent from the league. I'm really excited. I think he's gonna be really, really good, man.
It's sort of like when the Hawks got Schroeder. You know, a lot of people were talking about, you know, because they just seen pretty much mixtapes of him. And, you know, he didn't play here. He didn't play in college. And people just see his frames like, ooh, you know, I don't know if he's going to be good, but I have to watch that guy. So I felt like that's, you know, that just when you said that, that reminded me of when Schroeder came into Atlanta. It's just like, ooh, I don't know if he's going to be good, but I have to see what this guy can do on an NBA floor.
Hey, man, I think we had a good long show here. We might get it. I disappeared for like 30 seconds in the middle of it, so I can't wait to listen to your cabal rant. Where can they find you? Where can people find your work? Where can they find your work on Twitter? Well, first, where can they find you on Twitter, and then where can they find your work?
You can find me on Twitter at Bo Cherney, no spaces. Find my work at fanbuzz.com and hawksoup.com. So those are the plugs. Check them out if you get a chance. I'll enjoy your page views. And your comments on Twitter. I like comments on Twitter. So
yeah, you gotta look for the lion on Twitter. That's at O Cherney. Last name is Churney. Am I correct?
Yes, sir.
There we go.
The Simba avatar. It's my style now.
I'd be lying if I said that you weren't a great follow. See what I did there?
I did see what you did there.
All right, my man. So, hey, thanks for stopping by, man. And we'll definitely, I'd love to have you back on during the season. So we'll talk. Mm-hmm. We'll keep track of you guys. I'm a big fan of you guys and a big fan of your work and your great follow. So we'll catch up again soon, brother.
All right. It's nice to be on. Thanks.
Hi, man. Man, I need to really work on my podcasting skills. I don't know what's going on here. I look back and I think all these questions I might have missed. I don't know why. That's Bo Cherney, at Bo Cherney on Twitter. Real good follow. Smart guy. So I think next up, I'm trying to get Royce Young to come on. I got OKC. I got a couple of teams lined up. Utah. I might get Utah. So that's it for episode 8 of our Atlanta Hawks preview. I'm James Holis of bballbreakdown.com and all about being part of a conversation. You in? There you go, coach. I gave you a shout out. All right, man. You guys have a good one.